This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. This is our number two of the show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls. Our guest for this hour, Brady Kiesling, was a U.S. Foreign Service officer for 20 years. He served in Israel, Morocco, Armenia, Washington, and Greece. In 2003, he publicly resigned his post in the State Department to protest the administration's decision to go to war in Iraq. Since that time, he has been a visiting lecturer at Princeton and a columnist and speaker on international political affairs. He now has a book out that is an explanation, or perhaps exploration, some of both, of diplomacy and perhaps how American diplomacy has lost its way recently. The title of his book is Diplomacy Lessons, Realism for an Unloved Superpower. It's published by Potomac Books. It is out now. Brady Kiesling now lives in Athens, but he has been spending some time in the United States traveling around talking about the book. He is this morning in Austin, Texas, where yesterday he gave a lecture at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas. He's joining us by telephone, and we're pleased that he could be with us. Questions, of course, as we talk this morning are welcome. We just ask callers to please be brief, so that will help us to keep the program moving and to get in as many different people as possible. Certainly anybody who's listening can join the conversation. It's very easy. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and call us. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call for you, that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL, if that makes it any easier. Mr. Kiesling, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure to be here.
I appreciate it. Just for a moment, I wonder if we could go back to your decision to resign and your feelings that in advance of going into Iraq, your feelings that it was not a good idea and that it would not work to the interest of the United States. Can you talk a little bit about, in the run-up to that war, what was it that made you so certain that it would ultimately be proven to be a mistake?
It was a combination of factors. One thing was simply watching America's image in Greece melt down. Now, Greece has traditionally been unhappy with the U.S. because of our perceived support for the colonels when they were a dictatorship. President Clinton came to Greece in 1999, repaired a lot of the damage. All of a sudden, everything that I and my colleagues had done over decades to rebuild a strong relationship with an important NATO ally just collapsed in the anger of ordinary Greeks. That was one point. A second point was just having spent enough time in the Middle East, having talked to enough Middle Easterners to know that we were not trusted, we were not liked, no one believed in our good intentions, and we would not have the benefit of the doubt when we were trying to rebuild Iraq after we captured it. I mean, there's not a military problem. I know we'd make short work of the Iraqi military, but once we had done that, we had nothing to offer that the Iraqis were able to accept.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you look back, it can be a little bit confusing when one thinks about the various justifications for the war that were given. But it seems that the one that we have settled on was to not only to free a people from a ruthless dictator, but to help them to build a democratic society in the Western style, and for that to be a kind of model that perhaps other people who are interested in democratic reform in the Western style in the Middle East could look to, and that this would be the beginning, just the first step in a number of steps that would recreate the Middle East. That sort of is the basic premise. It sounds as if you would, from the get-go, you would have said, well, that sounds like a nice idea. But in fact, it seems very likely that it's just not going to work out that way. It can't work out that way.
Well, no one, I think, had ever been brave enough to tell President Bush that the democracy building the United States has done has succeeded not because we send bureaucrats into a country and tell them how to run their lives, but when we create an environment in which democracy succeeds. We could do that in the former Soviet Union, the former Warsaw Pact anyway. We tried to do it in Armenia, where I worked for 2 years very hard, with lots of money, good experts, and basically achieved very, very little. And that was one of the things that sobered me about going into Iraq, the idea that even in easy, ethnically homogeneous countries, America's ability to fix a broken society was incredibly limited.
And you obviously felt that it was important when you decided to resign that you do that in a public sort of a way, so that you, at least for yourself, went on the record of saying, look, I think that here we have some serious problems. I assume that you could have done it in a more quiet way if you would have wanted to.
Well, the only point of resignation was to raise the political cost of a bad foreign policy decision and to help people learn the appropriate lessons from that mistake as quickly and painlessly and cheaply as we could.
Hmm. What sort of response came to you from the State Department? And I guess I'm interested in anything that was more than just a kind of formal response. Was there any sort of genuine response to what you had to say?
Well, the State Department is just as diverse as the American people. I had friends send me letters of strong support, essentially saying they'd love to do it too, but they've got kids in college, or other things saying, no, we think the war is going to work, but we respect your integrity in resigning rather than, you know, staying on. The formal State Department report was the high road, a polite repetition of the formal talking points I used on the Greeks, you know, combined with, well, bye, it's been nice knowing you.
Mm-hmm. You, when you were in college, you studied archaeology. How is it that you went from there to going into the Foreign Service?
Studying archaeology and ancient history overseas gave me a taste for foreign languages and foreign cultures. And when I accidentally encountered U.S. diplomatic life visiting a friend in Bucharest, I suddenly realized here was a profession where the U.S. government paid you to figure out foreign countries. They paid you to learn languages. They launched you on the most interesting intellectual challenge that any human being can imagine.
Hmm. One of the basic questions I'd like to have you talk about, and certainly I think it's one of the questions that you explore in the book, is what exactly is the purpose of diplomacy? Why do we have a foreign service at all? What is it that we or any country is trying to achieve?
What people learn in the United States once they get old enough is that American society works on the basis of personal relationships, of social capital built up over years. The world works the same way. I mean, it's nice to talk about abstract national interests, the balance of power, things like that, but abstractions do not have interests. People have interests. People follow their interests, and personal interests are not exactly the same as the interests of the collectivity, say, of the American people. To get anything done in the world, you build personal relationships, relationships of trust, of reciprocity. And that's what diplomats do. They spend their lives fanning out around the world, building literally tens of thousands of working relationships with foreigners who need some personal reason to believe that a sometimes unpopular superpower can do things that coincide with their own interests.
And obviously here we're talking about the kind of activities that are carried out. They're not the kind of things that get a lot of attention. We're not talking about high-profile visits from the Secretary of State or anything like that. We're talking about the day-to-day, daily activities of people who work in the Foreign Service. Perhaps people have spent their professional lives working in the Foreign Service and don't get that kind of attention.
Well, that's true, though a high-level visit is part of the same relationship-building process. But yes, a lot of my job was breaking free of the embassy, which is hard to do because in a big embassy, we have lots of internal meetings and paperwork to keep us happy. But breaking free, finding people who were important to the United States in one way or another, convincing them that I was a responsible, interesting, useful representative of that superpower and that they should listen to me. It's time-consuming. You buy people lunches, you trade information, you're charming, and you also use your character and the prestige of the United States to get yourself a hearing.
Hmm. There must be, certainly in the working life of any diplomat, there must be many times when you're in the position of having to explain or perhaps justify some policy that the government of the United States has undertaken that the people there in your host country aren't going to like, aren't going to approve of.
Yeah, well, that's a given. I mean, one of the big things I needed to do shortly after 9/11 was explain to Greeks why our invasion of Afghanistan was appropriate, necessary, would benefit the world, would benefit the Greek people, would even benefit the people of Afghanistan. And that was an easy one because I firmly believed it. I had a lot of reservations about our ability to end terrorism or even to save the Afghans from themselves, but there was no question that the U.S. response was necessary under the circumstances. And that was an easy one to argue. Less easy was arguing the bombing of Serbia over Kosovo. That was a case where the U.S. made a judgment call. I would have made a slightly different judgment call. I would have given diplomacy a bit more time. I would have not dismissed, you know, the head of Serbia at the time, Milosevic, quite as cavalierly as Madeleine Albright did. But it was a judgment call. Our arguments were good. They were reasonably plausible, and by making them, you could establish that there was a moral, rational, and reasonable basis for the U.S. doing what it did.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Brady Kiesling. He was a U.S. Foreign Service officer for 20 years. In 2003, he publicly resigned in an effort to protest the Bush administration's decision to invade Iraq. His letter was published by the New York Times and was widely republished. He has since been a visiting lecturer at Princeton, has done writing and speaking on international political affairs. He makes his home now in Athens, in Greece, and has been for last month, or maybe a little bit more, spending time in the United States, traveling around, talking about his book, Diplomacy Lessons, Realism for an Unloved Superpower. Potomac Books is the publisher. He's in Texas today, nearing the end of a long tour, and I expect, no doubt, looking forward to going home.
This is true. I've got compelling personal reasons to be home.
Yeah. Your wife, is that the person that we're talking about is being so compelling you'd like to be home with?
Yes, I think that's a safe assumption.
Uh-huh. We do have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone here in Urbana on line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Mr. Kiesling, you appear to be one of a number of highly skilled federal employees who have resigned in disgust over many of the things that the current administration has done. And one of several objections is that political appointees or ideologues, who I call idiot-logs, have interfered with the various departments of the government, not only the Department of State, the Department of the Interior, the U.S. EPA, NOAA. Have you run into that personally in your career?
Definitely. I mean, every president has the absolute right to appoint people he trusts to senior positions.
Isn't this more extreme than other times?
Yes. I mean, the problem is that normally, you know, policymaking is a competitive process, and that competition is healthy. If a bunch of strong bureaucracies fight it out bitterly each of them representing the interests of some important U.S. constituency that needs to be represented, then by and large the results are good. What happened in this administration, though, is that ordinary bureaucratic competition was subverted by having a little network of disciplined, highly ideological political appointees who essentially short-circuited the decision-making mechanism, yanked it into the vice president's office or wherever it ended up, and left the bureaucrats out in the cold, essentially to execute decisions they had no part in making, decisions which bore very little resemblance to the real world that the bureaucrats had been working in.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. I'm sure that over time the image of the United States in the eyes of the rest of the world has had high points and low points. Do you think that the point at which we are now are we at an historic low, or is this just part of the natural up and down of the image of the United States?
I'd say that right when the Iraq War started was a historic low, certainly the lowest that it's ever been measured and since we began measuring in the 50s. It's perked up a bit since then, and the trend is not as global as it was at the time of Iraq. There are countries where we're doing better, countries where we're doing worse. Generally, we're still well down from where we need to be. The world is not a popularity contest. There are reasons why we're always going to be unpopular with a lot of people. We cannot please everyone. The difficulty is when we alienate ordinary citizens of the world enough, it raises the political cost to the politicians of doing what we need them to do. And it's bad policy.
There, I guess that gets at what is an important point, I suppose, that some people would argue that it's nice to be liked, but even better to be feared, and that you should expect a nation to have its interests and have them be selfish interests and will work to satisfy them. And if force is necessary, that's what's going to be applied. That's just the way that politics work. That's not exactly the way diplomats like to work, but that is the reality of international relations.
Well, it is the reality of our own schoolyard. It doesn't work in international relations for a very simple reason. When a superpower exerts overwhelming pressure on a foreign state, that state will just go limp. You know, it won't fight us. It'll just go limp. It'll collapse. When you look at what's happening in Iraq now, where a whole state structure has failed completely, if you look at Haiti, if you look at any number of countries where the U.S. needs an organized government to do the basic tasks of government, and that government cannot do it, when a government fails, the implications are very expensive for the American people. It's a breeding ground for terrorism. It's a breeding ground for economic devastation, for migration, for all kinds of things that we would rather not see.
To what extent is the tone of the entire Foreign Service set by the person at the very top, the Secretary of State?
The tone of the Foreign Service is set by the Secretary of State, but American policy is set by the President and the White House. We had this paradox when I came in of a Secretary of State that the whole Foreign Service instinctively respected. He was a genuinely gifted diplomat as well as a good bureaucrat. As impressive as anybody we've ever seen in the job. But he was faithfully carrying out the policies that a lot of us intellectually knew were seriously damaging to the interests of ordinary Americans. So it creates a tension. It's pretty amazing how much Powell continues to enjoy despite the manifest failures of the State Department to counteract the president's policy choice.
Again, our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Brady Kiesling, and we're talking about some of his experiences and some of the ideas that you will find in his recent book, Diplomacy Lessons, Realism for an Unloved Superpower, published by Potomac Books. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have that toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a caller here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, yes. Well, I'm just delighted with this program and this gentleman, and I'll ask it to end his name. And because, well, I'm in my 80s, but in high school, 60 years ago or more, I took a world history test, or no, it was more like geography. I think this president had never heard of the Tigris and Euphrates River. I just get hyper when I think about what he's done to that country, to Iraq, what is now Iraq, and I hardly talk because he didn't know where the Tigris and Euphrates, he had no idea of those people, that those people are tribal. He just thought he could take our army and Marines over there and wipe out Saddam. Well, he did that and should have gotten in a taxi and a sailboat and come home and not try to go over and run those people who are tribal. And I knew from the beginning, I'm still hyper about how the stupidity of most of the people who had never taken a geography course, they know nothing about the Egyptians, they know nothing about the tribes in those countries, and they're very tribal. Well, and I can tell you that from experience, my husband was asked to go over there and help in Afghanistan get their little college started, and he was the dean of engineering here, and I went with him because we went to the bank and borrowed the money, and the State Department paid his way, so I could go because I knew where Afghanistan was, and I knew where the Middle East was.
Let's bring the guest
well,
in here.
I think
and
our schools should
yes.
teach a geography now that you can get any place in the world in 2 or 3 hours by plane or 4 or 5 hours. And our schools should teach geography, should teach that those people are different than the Republicans and Democrats of this country.
Mm-hmm. Let me raise the question with you. I think, as the caller suggested, that the administration would have been in a position to take advantage of the advice of people who knew about the politics of the region. Surely there were people in the State Department that could have done that. Was it that, do you think that the advice wasn't solicited, that somehow they weren't interested?
Basically, the advice wasn't solicited. Washington is an incredibly competitive bureaucratic environment. The way you succeed in Washington is by figuring out what the president's inclinations are and providing him a piece of paper that suits those inclinations. Therefore, if you know that the experts are not going to support the president's inclinations, you simply don't ask them. And that's what happened. The State Department doggedly set up this little Iraq planning cell, and they did a bunch of very good work. If it had been, if their plans had been followed, it would have delayed the civil war in Iraq at least 6 months and maybe a year, and that would have been a good thing. But there was, bureaucratically, it did not serve anyone's purposes to listen to experts. And this is true around the world. It's not just an American problem. Most of the time, the real world, geography, tribes, history, are just an ornamental backdrop for, you know, for making the president look good to his voters and to the Congress. And I'm sorry to say it, but it's the reality we have to deal with.
Well, I appreciate the caller's thought. Let's go on to another, Chicago. This is line number four. Hello.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the long kind of a book review CNN channel you did, I believe it was for a Georgetown class. Anyway, pretty interesting. I guess the thing that kind of disturbs me on a lot of these discussions is the term American interest is thrown around. And it's kind of used as if everybody's speaking the same American interest. And if you're a citizen watching, listening to people talk, you think they're talking about your interests or the interests of the American people at large. And I think we'd be better served if we faced up to a lot of times what's going on here. I mean, nobody in Europe has any illusions that we went into Iraq to install a democracy or to... They all know exactly why we went in there. We went in there to try and set up three large military bases so that we could be sitting on top of and in the center of the world's oil. And only in America do people talk about in these kind of vague terms about why we went in there. I think it would serve everybody a lot better if we were completely honest about what the thing, what the reality was, why we went in there. Now, obviously, this small think tank, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and Pearl, miscalculated. It didn't work. We're not going to be able to set up three bases there and tell everybody what price to sell us the oil at. But I think we'd be better served if we were a little more honest about what one group of people's interests are versus what the American people's interests are. Obviously, it was not in the American people's interest to now be in debt for hundreds of billions of dollars for the rest of their lives and have totally wrecked our economy. So I think it's better if we, instead of talking in vague terms, we're really talking across purposes, and we're thinking the American people accept their definition for what we're saying, and it's not. It doesn't matter how stupid George Bush is. He's not the one that was running the show there. He barely knew what he was, well, like the woman said, he barely knew what he was talking about. But that's the point. Thank you.
Yeah, all right. Well, you want to comment on that?
Well, it's... I think our caller's being a little too hard on American public servants. Everybody I ever met in the Foreign Service, and pretty much everyone I ever met in the civil service too, genuinely believed that he or she was working for the interests of the American people. And of course, you're quite right. There are 300 million Americans today. Each of those people has a slightly different set of interests. Often those interests conflict with each other. So, you know, we elect a president who we have some kind of, maybe it's naive faith that he will look after most of our interests pretty well. And for me, that means our physical security, our economic security over the next 5 and 50 and maybe even 500 years. And that's, it's a matter of stewardship, of leadership, of looking at long-term solutions to the long-term problems facing us. And if you put things in those terms, it's you can talk about U.S., you know, about the interests of the American people. You know, when you invade Iraq, it helps some people, it hurts other people. Made a few people rich, killed a few people, well, a lot of, well, killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, 3,000 Americans. But the balance of those interests has to be looked at in the long term in a humane way that respects history. And when you do that, very few wars make sense.
Let's go to someone else back here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. Yes, it seems to me that my initial indication this war was a grave mistake was the tremendous number of civilian deaths caused by the war. Now, if you were president, what would you do from here?
Well, if there were a good solution to Iraq, I wouldn't have resigned. It would have been my job to stay a soldier on and help that. There's not a good solution. I would say that having failed pretty abjectly at every goal America set, except the sort of, in retrospect, ridiculous one of proving that Saddam did not have weapons of mass destruction. Now, our only honorable goal is to keep as many innocent Iraqis alive as we can. And that means figuring out a way to withdraw from the mess that strengthens Iraqi leaders, gives them the legitimacy they need to control their own territory, and to reassert the state's monopoly of violence there. And this is nice fancy words, in practice very difficult. I mean, what I've said, and I don't have a specific way to do it because I don't know Iraqi tribal politics well enough. I don't know how the militias all interact, react with each other. There are people who do. We need to talk to them and figure out a strategy that allows some one, two, or three Iraqi leaders to take the credit for our departure so that they can become, you know, the George Washingtons or the Mahatma Gandhis or even, well, probably more likely the Kim Il-sungs of their people, you know, the liberator of the nation. And a liberator of the nation has a little bit of time to prove that he can govern, and maybe we'll get somebody like that. But that's what our thinking has to be, how to move out in a way that empowers Iraqi leaders.
Would a division of the country into the three prominent sects be a plausible solution?
Well, there's no tidy division possible because the populations are too mixed up, especially in Baghdad. Kurdistan is already effectively independent. A lot of our diplomacy now is devoted to keeping them from insisting on that independence too loudly, because that will cause massive problems with Turkey and Iran. For the rest of the country, you know, the federal solution, that's what the State Department had always proposed. It will have to be a federal solution, but what those lines should be is very open to question, and you need a system that maintains the local political balances so that especially the Sunni do not feel that they have lost all control of their destiny to the Shiites.
Well, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. I think one of the things that you write here in the book is diplomacy relies on one rigid and indispensable rule of diplomacy, the rule of sovereign equality. All states are equal. All heads of government are equal. All ambassadors are equal. Well, the fact of the matter is, though, that's not the case. All states aren't in reality. And the accusation of the Bush administration is that it has pressed its advantage to the utmost, saying essentially to the rest of the world, this is our policy. If you don't like it, tough. How exactly in a diplomatic way, do you balance the ideal with the fact that the United States does indeed have interests, and that we want to that we're going to work to further those interests, just like any country is?
Yes, and it is understood that every country promotes its interests. The idea behind sovereign equality is by performing certain diplomatic rituals to prove mutual respect, you take our superpower status off the table as a domestic political problem for the people who have to deal with us. Look at any politician in the world. When he deals with the United States, he is dealing from a position of weakness. His own population is staring at him intently for any sign that he has bowed to the superior force of the outsiders. Doing that is incredibly delegitimizing for a leader. His population loses faith in him. So a superpower, to protect the people who work with us, has to go out of its way to prove its respect, to prove that anything that happens is a matter of negotiation between equals. And of course, in reality, it can't be a negotiation between equals, but if we do not act as if it is, we will undercut precisely the people we desperately need to get our business done.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you also make the argument that in diplomacy there does have to be some give and take, and that indeed you have to be prepared. If there's something you as a country want, you have to be prepared to give something in exchange. And it sounds as if maybe one of the criticisms you might level against this administration is that they never acknowledged that fact, that they had to give up anything. You know, the idea of making some sort of concession or trying to find out, well, what is it the other side wants and can we give them something? It seemed that was not really much ever considered.
Yeah, that's a crucial point you make. Thanks. Look at one of the great triumphs of U.S. diplomacy, the peace deal between Israel and Egypt. The reason Israel gave up the Sinai is, very crudely and cynically, we pay them $3 billion a year for their renouncing that little bit of their sacred national territory. I mean, obviously, it's sacred Egyptian territory as well. So, to buy that peace deal, the United States taxpayer is writing a check every year to Israel for $3 billion. And that may be a good investment, but we were willing to pay that price because giving money to Israel is not bad domestic politics. Giving money to North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons is terrible domestic politics. And you know, poor President Bush, he's now, you know, he saw the light after 3 years of wasting opportunities in North Korea. He's gotten diplomatic, and that's good. What he hasn't figured out, though, is he going to be brave enough to, well, to pay the North Koreans for giving up what they see as a major element of their national security. And it's not an easy transaction. You don't take out your credit card and say, I'll take six of your nuclear weapons and put it on my bill. It's a much more complicated, delicate task, and it may not even be possible in the near term. Mm-hmm. Probably isn't possible. However, the mere fact of having this negotiation going on makes the world slightly more stable and reduces the risk of embarrassing, deadly accidents.
Well, I think one of the criticisms specifically about North Korea that was labeled against the administration is that almost out of the box, it took this very belligerent stand. And the president said a lot of insulting things about the leader and the government of North Korea, said that they were part of this axis of evil, and that it seems that despite everything that we say about not intending to attack North Korea, it seems that on their side they feel threatened by the United States, which gets to this question of, you know, in diplomacy, is it ever right to be not diplomatic? I mean, in the sense that is the idea always that the first option, the best option, is to try and be civil if you can at least be friendly? You know, at what point do you actually, if you are concerned about that another nation's policies threaten yours, at what point do you actually start to talk very tough and to take an aggressive posture if not to be aggressive in fact? I mean, how does one balance those two things, sort of trying to be accommodating and saying, look, let's talk about this, and balance that with this with the other kind of position that says if you don't do what we want, there are going to be serious consequences?
Well, anyone who is serious about diplomacy never insults a foreign leader publicly. I mean, it's insanely counterproductive. You insult foreign leaders only for one purpose, which is to show off to the folks back home. And that's what John Bolton did when he insulted Kim Jong-il. It's what President Bush did when he called it the axis of evil. This was purely to swagger for a domestic audience, and I'm afraid it's something politicians like to do. That's life. But the only time a diplomat ever insults a foreign leader is when he knows that his country is already determined to go to war. And we were not determined to go to war with North Korea. So it was just childish behavior.
Our guest, Brady Kiesling, was a U.S. Foreign Service officer for 20 years. He served in Israel, Morocco, Armenia, Washington, and Greece. In 2003, he resigned publicly from the Foreign Service to protest the decision by the Bush administration to go to war in Iraq. The letter was published in the New York Times. Since, he's been a visiting lecturer at Princeton and columnist and speaker on international political affairs. He is now spending some time in the United States, traveling around talking about his recently published book, Diplomacy Lessons, Realism for an Unloved Superpower. Potomac Books is the publisher, and he is this morning in Texas, looking forward to going home to Athens, where he's living now. Questions are welcome. We have several. We'll try to get in as many as we can in about the 10 minutes that we have left. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. And I believe we'll start here with Belgium, line number, town nearby, line number four. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I would like to flesh out the conversation you just had there just a little bit more with your guest. And the point he made between the Egyptian and Israeli agreement to pay the Israelis and give the land to the Egyptians, doesn't that really just point out the entire problem we have in the Middle East? We take one side above, you know, above everybody else. Now, it's not always the Israeli side, but it seems they do get a lot of the attention. And don't we need to be a little fair, a little bit more even?
Well, the one problem we face is because we are a superpower, everyone feels that we have the ability to dispense justice, and the fact that there is no justice in the world is therefore at least indirectly our fault. Greeks and Turks are both convinced that we coddle the other side at their expense. In the Middle East, of course, every Middle Eastern country believes that we are slavishly devoted to Israel. The reality is no, it's not slavish. There is a very powerful political connection that often trumps common sense. But you know, we try to keep the balances. U.S. diplomats at the moment are pretty frustrated because U.S. domestic politics makes it very hard to push to effectively represent American interests in the Middle East. But this may pass. Let's hope it does.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Thank you. Let us continue. We'll go next to talk with somebody, I believe, in Terre Haute, Indiana, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Wasn't there some kind of an agreement that the Clinton administration had with North Korea regarding nuclear power and supplying them with petroleum that was canceled by the Bush administration almost immediately after they took power?
Yes, so there was definitely an agreement. It lasted for several years. It had some good effects. The problem is the North Koreans claim we didn't fully live up to our side of the deal, and we were not sure that the North Koreans were living up to their side of the deal. The North Korean nuclear program is so non-transparent that we didn't have faith in it. The deal cost the Clinton administration heavily in Congress with, you know, congressional hawks. So there was not wild enthusiasm about it. And once an excuse came up to cancel it, you know, the new administration did that. And the who's to blame there, I can't say. There was a brief window for negotiations. Colin Powell pushed for negotiations early on in the administration. He was overruled by the White House, and the momentum disappeared.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. And let's, I think, go back here to someone in Urbana, I believe, line one. Hello.
I have the strong feeling that part of our problem is testosterone poisoning and men trying to prove their manhood to other men. At least that's what I feel with the Bush administration. And it really bugs me that when some people, including the Democratic presidential candidate, said we needed to essentially do what you're talking about in terms of understanding, that he was excoriated for, quote, being nice to terrorists. Your point of view is excoriated by conservatives as being nice, as opposed to being smart. If you're not tough and if you don't beat up on everybody, you're not man enough, and you're not speaking of the country. And even Condoleezza Rice, she's not man enough if she doesn't stand up to these guys the way the conservatives want them to. So that's my take on things. It's all these guys who weren't in the service, did not serve, have to prove their manhood. Thanks a bunch.
Yeah, well, there is truth to the fact that most of what happens in the world is a product of small group dynamics, of people who need to dominate the little group of people around them. It would be lovely if we lived in a world where people had enough faith in their own rationality that they would judge one another based on how smart we are and how good our solutions are in the real world. But we don't have faith in our ability to make that judgment. We have a lot of faith in our ability to make character judgments. And one of the reasons President Bush has tended to cultivate an atmosphere of crisis, for example, the so-called war on terrorism, which analytically is nonsensical, is in a time of crisis, people will look for signs of character, for signs of toughness, willingness to do whatever it takes to keep the herd safe. And unfortunately, our judgments of character are relatively flawed, and testosterone does play a role, but let's not be sexist here. There are plenty of people like Condoleezza Rice who have exactly the traits to enable this kind of destructive way of looking at the world.
Well, let's go to Champagne for another caller. This is line two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I wanted to build on, you made a statement that you don't insult another leader unless you're ready to go to war. I wonder how you would apply that to Hugo Chavez at the UN or Ahmadinejad at the UN. Or is that dynamic different?
Well, the dynamic's a little different. They basically have given up on diplomacy with the U.S. They've decided that there's the cost-benefit from it is too small. Therefore, they're simply posturing to their domestic audience to look good, sort of in the certainty that it doesn't really matter what they say to the U.S. There's not going to be a good relationship anyway. But they're also confident that the U.S. is mature enough not to take their insult seriously. That latter calculation, frankly, I do not have a lot of respect for either of these people. They've both wasted enormous opportunities to make the world a little safer and better. But that said, perhaps the Bush-Chavez model of international relations is catching on. I hope not.
We have a couple of minutes left. I want to, again, in a sense, go back to a basic point, and that is as far as the United States is concerned, what are the costs? I've talked about the fact that, and I think it is fair to say that the administration has been accused of unilateralism in the extreme, essentially saying to the rest of the world, these are our policies, this is what we're going to do. Either you're with us or against us. If you don't like it, too bad. What is the cost to the United States of that kind of posture?
The cost is our inability to mobilize the resources of our allies when we need them for something. At the moment in Afghanistan, leave aside Iraq, which is intractable, to fix Afghanistan it might be possible with enough tens of billions of dollars committed over 5 or 10 or 15 years to rebuild a country that is completely poverty-stricken and dysfunctional. When you create an alliance of people who are all convinced in the necessity of the mission, who are convinced that the principle of sovereign equality applies, we are all in this together as partners, then foreign leaders can take the chance to go to their own taxpayers and say, I'm sorry, we need to borrow a couple billion dollars to fix the starving Afghans. You can't do that when you are an unwilling, sort of dragged-in stage prop to show the American people that the American president is not unilateral. And that's unfortunately what we did in Afghanistan. I mean, there were reasons why when we invaded, it was easier to do it on our own because it was a very fast, subtle, high-tech operation and bringing in foreigners would get in the way of it. But we took our eye off the long-term problem, which is fixing a failed state, and that takes a lot of willing help and money. And generally speaking, anything we do that's unilateral costs us 10 times as much as something we do with our partners, just because the legitimacy of a good partnership means resistance from our proposed beneficiaries will be less. I can't give you exact numbers, but as a general rule, we have to be multilateral and diplomatic because it's much, much cheaper than being unilateral and military.
Do you think that the approach to foreign policy the Bush administration has taken has actually hurt the Foreign Service?
Definitely. Morale is terrible. The retiring class of the Foreign Service was the largest in anyone's memory. The good news is the intake is also large. 9/11 sparked new interest in the profession. The young people coming in, they're idealistic. They're living the disaster of Iraq. Like their predecessors at the time of Vietnam, they will get smart from that mistake. And I'm pretty confident that the pendulum is already shifting and in 10 or 15 years will be better than ever.
Well, at that, we will have to close. We're here at the end of the time. Again, if you would like to read the book that we've mentioned a couple of times, it's titled Diplomacy Lessons, Realism for an Unloved Superpower by our guest John Brady Kiesling. It's published by Potomac Books. Brady Kiesling was a U.S. Foreign Service officer for 20 years. He served in a number of places around the world, Israel, Morocco, Armenia, Washington, and Greece. He resigned in 2003. It's his way of protesting the Bush administration's decision to go to war in Iraq. He's now making his home in Greece, spending some time in the United States to talk about the book, but soon gets to go home. Mr. Kiesling, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, David.